The great Australian writer David Malouf passed away last week. David's novels include Ransom, The Great World, Remembering Babylon, Jono, and my favourite, An Imaginary Life. He also published collections of poetry and essays. David's preoccupations as a writer included Italy, where he had lived for many years, along with all the myths and the literature of the classical world. But he equally had a deep fascination and fondness for the disappeared childhood world of his hometown, Brisbane. I interviewed David many times, and he was always thoughtful and precise and famously generous and encouraging to young writers. There was also a personal connection with David. My mum, Maureen, had known him at the University of Queensland back in the 1950s. And when any of her seven kids bailed David up for a chat after one of his readings, he would remember those years and her affectionately. David had moved back to Queensland, to the Gold Coast, in fact, a place which might seem very un-David Malouf when you think of his writing, but his apartment was full of his extraordinary collection of original artworks, and he'd sit high up and watch the ocean with a book of poetry on his lap. When I last visited with my kids, he served us Black Forest chocolate cake and walked with us down to the beach. And he was over 90 by this stage, but had only recently stopped ocean swimming. He said that he'd nearly been caught in a rip and realised he was too self-conscious about drawing attention to himself to raise a hand for the lifeguard. Definitely a different generation. In person, David was dignified and graceful. He had a certain formality, but right to the end remained deeply interested in the world and in people. Richard spoke with David Malouf back in 2014, just after his 80th birthday, and we're bringing you that conversation now. I'm so glad we can together hear his gentle voice and, of course, read his words.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
David Malouf has just turned 80. He's the author of so many classic Australian works of fiction. He's also a poet and an essayist. And as an essayist, he writes beautifully about a particular foreign country. None of us can ever travel to that place because it is Australia, the Australia of his childhood in the 1940s. I was born decades after David, and I can only recognise that older Australia through the memories of my grandparents. This is the Australia of plain food, of busy houses with neighbours coming in and out all day, where Protestants and Catholics found it hard to attend each other's weddings, let alone intermarry. The Australia where people amuse themselves of an evening by listening to music or quiz shows on the radio and playing the piano or sitting down to a round of bridge. This is an Australia where children would start the day looking pristine and come home filthy and were given spoonfuls of cod liver oil and milk of magnesia for their health. When I try to explain this world to my children, they just think I'm being weird, and I suspect they think I'm making it all up. David Malouf remembers all of this with evident fondness, but he's not sentimental about it. And it's true that he welcomes much of the change for the past six decades. But I just love talking with him about this stuff because he's writing about another Australia that happened right here, where we live today. For this, his 80th year, there's a new collection of his essays called A First Place and a new volume of his poetry called Earth Hour. Happy birthday, David Malouf.
Thank you, Richard.
We are in the ABC studios in Brisbane right now, in South Brisbane. We're just about three blocks or so from the spot where your family home once was, where you grew up. Is it strange to be here sitting in Langston?
Unrecognisable. My grandmother's shop is actually still there on the corner of Melbourne Street and Edmundston Street, but virtually the whole of Edmundston Street has disappeared. And It was very typical of the mixture in this part of Brisbane because it had very, very large old houses, often running from one street through to the next, so that behind the house there was a tennis court, then a garden, then an orchard.
An orchard,
yeah, with lots of fruit trees and lemon trees particularly. A chook house, always. Then there were cottages, but then also in Melbourne, in Edmondson Street, on the corner of Melbourne and Edmondson Street was Simpson's Flour Factory. And on the next corner was something called the Vulcan Can Company, which made tins. And we used to, after school, we would go there and get cut-offs of the long strips of tin, which you could take home and turn into various objects.
You wrote a couple of years ago that some years ago you were in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and you thought you'd better see some other part of Scotland. So you went to Dundee and arrived at night and woke up the next morning, had your breakfast, stepped outside, and you were completely floored. Why was that such a shocking thing?
Because it was exactly the smells, the faces of people in the street, the whole atmosphere could have been that of Australia in 1940. And, of course, we had changed enormously. And Dundee had also changed, but it had changed, but nevertheless kept its habits, its style, its food, because they were original. And we, too, had had that as our original style, and over the 50 or so years had changed it so radically that you wouldn't recognise it any longer.
I know. Where did it go? Did it slip away just one day? I wonder.
It's no, funny, it changed it? Because a lot of new people came and showed us other ways of living. I think the main thing it was because we slowly woke up to the notion that we weren't living in the counties in England or in Scotland or Ireland, that the climate was completely different, so that we'd better change our clothes and our eating habits to something that fitted more with where we actually were rather than where we had come from.
When I was little, I used to know every inch of my family home. I used to, I think my sister did as well. You know, we, like most kids, we crawled all over it and knew it much better than our parents did. Do you still have that memory of your family home, which was only two doors down from your grandparents' shop?
Yeah. Look, people are always asking you what it's like to be 80. And all I can say about that is that you just have more years and more ages that you can go back to in memory and find yourself existing in. So I have a very, very clear memory of what it was like to be 4 or 5 or 8 or 10 or whatever it is in that particular house. And the fact that we moved from that house and then had a quite different style of living later makes it easier to go back to those memories, because the particular light of that house, the particular kind of relationship with weather and sky that a tin roof provides... especially in a subtropical climate like Brisbane, you know, it's easy to think your way back into the skin of that little kid back there in those rooms under that roof with that particular relationship of light and dark that the house had.
Openness seemed to be the biggest feature of it, the way you describe it. Openness.
Yes. Well, the house is open to the street in one way because it has verandas. But the verandas are also a border, and there are people who get up the front steps onto the veranda who never get into the house. You know, salesmen would come selling sheets and towels and stuff, and they would lay all their wares out. They'd open their suitcases and lay the wares out there, but they didn't get into the house.
Well, there was a border, even though the door was open, the front door's open.
Even though the front door was open, yeah.
There's that kind of invisible border.
Yes, there's invisible border. And then the next stage of that was the interior of the house. And the interior of the house, because it was surrounded by verandas, was quite dark. But one of the rules in those kind of houses, and I don't know why that was so, maybe it was that people thought that that was how breezes circulated. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that you were not supposed to have a secret or private life, and you could only have that life behind a closed door. So the rule was that doors were left open or ajar. Even if you were in the bathroom, the door was left ajar.
Even in the bathroom?
Even in the bathroom, yes.
How is any kind of privacy maintained then?
Well, you learn not to look, and you learn not to hear what you're not supposed to see or hear. And, you know, there are conventions about that. Of course, you do see those things and you do hear those things, but nobody ever mentions them.
It just seems like another world, doesn't it? And it's so different from, I think, to other cities, other Australian cities with different kinds of houses.
It wouldn't be very different, I suspect, from the kind of life that people live in most of Southeast Asia or in India, for example.
The Brisbane houses of tin and timber, you said they're more like tree houses than houses, like cubby houses almost, and very open in that way as well. Was there a sense of shame sometimes attached to these old Brisbane tin and timber homes that were there in place?
I think until very late there was, and that was because they represented a kind of poverty. You know, rich cities build in stone, and stone is permanent, and Brisbane was a city made of wood and of local wood, which was cheap. And people didn't necessarily see those houses as beautiful. They saw them as convenient, except that there were architects here, Dodds, for example, who realised that those houses could also be beautiful. But mostly they were just pretty functional.
And portable too. Mm. You could put them on the back of a truck.
Yeah, you could do that. And but that suggested that they were not permanent and that there was a kind of makeshift quality about the houses. And we had all, as kids, we used to love to sit on the front lawn and watch a whole house go by on the back of a lorry. And later on, I went with a friend who had been born there in 1933 to Chiligo in North Queensland. And when we got there off the train, there was nothing in sight. It was just lawyer vines and a pub and a butcher shop. But that had been when he was born there in 1933. It had a population of 11,000. And all the houses had been taken from Chiligo to create the town of Mareeba, 100 miles away. So you could actually pick up a whole town and translate it somewhere else. That gives you a quite strange notion of what permanence and impermanence are. And I think that's pretty rare, if anywhere, but certainly rare in Australia.
You know, I'm thinking the exact opposite, because you're really alive to the differences between Australian cities. So Brisbane is Adelaide. Adelaide, where all the houses are very heavy and made out of stone, the older houses I'm talking about, and they seem to be permanence and immovable. I know you think that different houses tend to produce different habits of mind and activity. I just wonder, you know, maybe Brisbane people are more likely to be breezy and portable, where Adelaide are solid and immovable and respectable and all those things. I don't know.
Quite know how far that goes, but certainly I think that as little people, we begin to map the world in terms of the first domestic spaces we encounter. And so the idea of inner and outer is very, very strong in a Queensland house because of the verandas and the nest of rooms at the centre. But also the idea of above and below is very strong because those houses, because the terrain is hilly everywhere, those houses were built on stumps that were often maybe 2 or 3 feet high at one end of the hallway of the house and 18 or 19 feet high at the other end of the hallway, which would only be a few metres, so that there was a huge wedge of space underneath the house, which was, of course, of the same dimensions as the house above. But because the house above was familiar and had its uses and was lived in, and the space below was empty, that space seemed much larger and much wilder to kids than the house above. So, you know, when you got down there and you stood at one end of it and you're at a place where it's maybe 18 feet high, and what you see not very far away is stumps that are only 3 feet high. If you think of that as a forest, it's a big forest.
And it's a place that grown-ups very rarely venture into, but it's like a secret world to kids down there, isn't it? All the stuff.
Well,
that
that's
falls
where
between
you could go to sulk, or it's where animals went to die. For example, I can one of my very very earliest memories is my mother had a little dog, and we had an old stove down under the house because that's where everything that you no longer had any use for was abandoned. So down there, there were old stoves, old bathtubs, old buckets, old bedsteads. All those iron bedsteads would go down there. And the dog went to die underneath the stove down there. So I always associated that place with the death of that dog. But, you know, it's where children went and played. They went and played doctors and nurses, and it's where they had mostly their first curious discoveries of sexual difference and all of that kind of stuff. So under the house is not just a secret and dark place. It's a bit like Freud's notion of the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a different style of house, where all those unwanted objects go is into the attic. And the attic is the secret place that kids like to go and explore, and where they go and find all these objects that belong to their parents' past or the house's past. In Queensland, it's underneath, not above.
Freudian, you know, ideas say that, you know, when we dream of a house, where was it? Maybe it's Jung, I don't know, I can't remember, but the house is represents the self in our dreams all the time,
sure,
in these spaces. I wonder what it says if we put a... if we're throwing all our old broken stuff up into the top of our heads, as opposed to the old broken stuff going down to the basements, down to the bottom part.
Well, it's interesting that when Freud wants to find a metaphorical embodiment for the unconscious, you enter it through a kind of trapdoor. You didn't have to go through the trapdoor in Queensland. You just went down the back stairs. And there you
there
were.
It all it was, this whole wonder world of that the parents never went into. You mentioned your grandparents, they had a shop on that corner of Evanston Street and Melbourne Street, I think it was, in Brisbane, South Brisbane. They were Lebanese migrants to Australia. What was the shop like? Can you get a picture of that shop?
The shop was rather grand.
It was an emporium, was it?
No, it wasn't an emporium. It was a corner shop, but it had beaten tin ceilings, which are quite beautiful, you know, as they were
stenciled,
in those days.
Yes.
Lilies and stuff. It had a proper marble milk bar where you could make malted milks and things like that. And it had marble top tables with bent wood chairs. So it was a kind of cafe as well as a corner shop. And then there was a place where there was all the fruit and vegetables in tilted boxes. And then there was a counter where there were huge biscuit and lolly jars, those big round glass jars that were filled with lollies and biscuits. So for kids, that too was a kind of magical place. We went there quite often, but were forbidden to eat anything, so that we were not supposed to eat between meals, so we couldn't have biscuits or lollies or whatever. And we were not allowed to drink soft drinks, except at the weekend. And malted milks were made at home when we came from school. So we went down there, and there were all of these things, but they were sort of untouchable. And I actually grew up with a very strange notion of how economy worked, because we had a girl called Cassie who essentially brought us up. And we sometimes went...
Yeah, sorry, you had a girl. What does that mean, sorry?
Well,
a servant of a kind? Or
Well, in those days, a very, very large number of people had someone working in the house. And Cassie was a farm girl who'd come to work for my mother when my sister was born. And she did the cooking and she did the cleaning. And she mostly brought my sister and me up. And we sometimes went to town with her and sometimes with my mother, but we had been told that you never asked for anything in town to be bought. There was no point. There'd be lots of things on counters and lots of things that you might want, but there is no point in asking for them because they were only there for show. And so I spent a very part of my small boyhood believing that town was this series of shops, which was a bit like the Easter exhibition. Oh, you know,
it was a showcase.
It was a showcase. Yeah, but nothing really to be bought.
That's a pretty good. I wish I'd thought of that with my own kids. I think. What kind of food did your grandparents eat in surrounding?
My grandparents ate proper Lebanese food. I mean, they ate cabbage rolls. And they made kibbeh, which is meat and ground wheat. They made tabbouleh, what I now know as tabbouleh salad. They also made proper toss salad. And they, to my sister and my disgust, they put oil on almost everything. Oil in those days, olive oil, was something you bought in a small blue bottle at the chemist. And it was medicinal.
Really?
Yes. And you mostly took it to open your bowels. So we could not understand how when we went to my grandparents, they were pouring this stuff all over everything they ate.
From the chemist. Your mum was born in England.
My mother was born in England.
And your dad is the son of Lebanese migrants to Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
Was their marriage incredibly improbable?
In those days, pretty improbable, yeah.
So how did they meet?
Well, my father was a great sportsman, and he played rugby league for Queensland. And when he was probably about 18 or 19, he became a boxer. And he was a very, very famous boxer. I mean, I've got all the cuttings which my mother kept. And I spent most of my childhood being stopped by people in the street, men in the street, saying, "You're Georgie Maloof's boy, aren't you? You know, the best fight I ever saw was your father's fight with Archie Bradley or whoever it was." And so my grandfather, my mother's father, he was a descendant of a man called Daniel Mendoza, who in the late 18th century was more or less the inventor of modern boxing. He was the first professional boxer.
Wow.
And he was a friend of Byron's and had a gym and so on. And three or four of his children came to Australia, two of the boys for shoplifting and burglary and two of the girls for prostitution or something. But the rest of the family, which stayed back there, was very, very respectable. And my grandfather was one of the people who had descended from people who stayed back there. So he was a passionate follower of boxing. And so he discovered my father and kind of, I think, fell in love with him at first sight, you know, as an absolute embodiment of everything that he thought a boxer and a sort of a clean living young man should be.
Your dad sounded like a lovely man.
Yeah.
Was he a lovely man?
He was. And so he was invited home. He would have been about 22 then, I suppose. My mother would have been about 16. And they started going out together almost immediately. And my grandfather's son owned a section at the markets, fruit and vegetables section at the markets. And my father was then employed as one of their carriers because he owned a small trucking business. So
he was 22 and your mum was 16.
16, yeah.
How long did their courtship last before they got married?
They didn't get married until she was 32. So it was
16 years?
15, 16 years, yeah. And I mean, the difficulty of all, they went out continually from that time, and I've got letters, and you know, they were not very often separated, but when they were, he wrote her letters and
they must have been burning cards.
Well, I think in the end they took matters into their own hand and managed to get pregnant with me.
With you. So you finally broke the stalemate there.
Yeah.
In that sense. So was there reluctance on your mother's family side to the match? Or was it a religious thing,
or rather,
a racial thing?
Rather shockingly, and certainly very shockingly to my mother and my grandfather, broke off relations with them and forbade all his children to go to their wedding. I mean, I didn't know that until after my mother's death.
Was that because the Lebanese side of the family were Catholics?
They were Catholics, and my mother's family were Jewish, yeah. I was fascinated. I think all children are fascinated by the accident that brings their parents together and them into existence. You know, if you know that film called Back to the Future, that's really about a young man's finding his way back to the past and trying to get his parents married so that he will come into existence. And there's a wonderful Thomas Hardy poem about his imagining of the first moment in a small Dorsetshire village when his mother in the pew looked up into the gallery where the musicians were playing and caught his father's eye because he was a violinist. And he knows that this is the moment when he was conceived, really, that is, in mind. I think for anyone in Australia, there is a huge accident, really, that brings their parents together because we all come from such distant places to meet. And I think in my parents' case, that was a very, very large accident that brought those two people together and me into the world.
Yeah, I think all of our existences are vanishingly improbable, you know, in terms of, you know, this, whatever. But yours even more so, I think, that they were able to stay loyal to each other for 15, 16 years.
Yeah. For that I think that very largely what made them not push the issue was a kind of dutifulness that they both had. They were both kind of utterly family and oriented and had strong filial obligations. So, you know, duty really meant something in those days.
We were just talking about your parents' long courtship then. You've seen some of the correspondence that they had in those brief times when they were separated. What's the language like? What's your dad's language like when he's writing letters to your mum?
My father left school probably when he was 12, went to be a boy with Cobb & Co. up at Nanango. And the letters are very, very formally written. I mean, they're really eloquent in a kind of old-fashioned style, which was amazing for me when I saw them.
He says things like, "I must say," and "dear me."
Yes. And, you know, what that partly tells you about is the kind of primary school education kids in his day had, which was still, I must say, the kind of primary education I had in my day too, where a lot of kids in Queensland left school at 13, went at the end of year 7, the vast majority of them, and the more intelligent they were, the more likely they were to leave school rather than go on. But they left school absolutely numerate and absolutely literate. Not only did they have a grasp of syntax that allowed them to sort of read as well as write a proper complex sentence, but they had been introduced to pretty well the whole of English poetry, a lot of Australian writing, all sorts of interesting speeches and essays, Emerson's essays, the Gettysburg Address, all of those things. It was part of the policy of education in Queensland in those days that you had to provide a 13-year-old kid with enough grasp of the language and its literature and of ideas to enable them to build an utterly literate life for themselves.
So this was how education in Queensland was right up until the 1960s, where...
Later, 1974.
Children would receive this intense education, this very intense education, and at the end of primary school, at 13, they'd get out. Nearly all of them would get out of the school system. What kind of secondary education was there for kids?
The secondary education was mostly provided not by the state, but by other sources, the churches, but also by merchant groups. And that had been a policy that they'd accepted from the beginning, that the state government would put all its resources into primary school education. Absolutely superb teaching, absolutely fantastic buildings and facilities. And what they would then do is have an examination at the end of primary school, and if you pass that examination, the government paid half your fees at any private school you wanted to go to. And they themselves had secondary schools. There was only one secondary school in Brisbane, which was State High, and a technical college and a commercial college, and a few high schools in large towns throughout Queensland, but 95% of the secondary education was provided by other sources than government sources.
So the vast majority of Queensland kids went into the workforce at the age of 13 or 14 then?
Yes.
That's extraordinary.
And they went usually as, say, the boys were office boys in firms, which they would one day become CEO of.
Extraordinary. It just seems like a whole other world. Were you exposed as a kid in wartime Brisbane to, do you have memories of the war, of the huge amount of American servicemen and women that flooded into Brisbane all of a sudden? Was it 500,000 or 1 million that came into Brisbane all of a sudden?
Well, passed through Brisbane, yes. Yeah. But Brisbane was only about, I think it was under 400,000 people at that time. So if you put 100,000 servicemen from elsewhere into the city, the whole town changes. Most of those were Americans. And the city really became completely Americanized. And for us, it was a complete revelation because it's difficult to explain that Australia was actually quite closed off from the world all through the 20s and 30s and had not developed really very much from the end of the First World War. So that the world we saw, which was the modern world, the world of skyscrapers and, highways and everything, we saw that on the screen.
Movies.
It was movies. And that was obviously one day would be our future, but the future hadn't arrived here. And then suddenly, boats come into the harbour and there are all of these sailors lined up with their white caps like something out of a musical. And then they're in the streets. And what that was the future arriving just suddenly overnight. And, we did change and catch up. And that happened very quickly. But Brisbane kind of got that shock wave of it first, I think.
I think we looked very quaint to the Americans, didn't we? We looked quaint and old-fashioned and British to them.
Very British,
And very British. Your part of Brisbane, South Brisbane, was a special area too in its own way because it was the only place that black American servicemen were allowed to live.
Yes, they were not allowed to cross any of the bridges into the city.
Why not? Who whose decision was that?
It wouldn't have been the Americans' idea. No. I think it was probably our idea. We had first of all suggested to the Americans that they should not send black soldiers because we were a white country and we wanted to be saved by whites. The Americans said they're coming anyway, and at some point the government said, well, if they come, they can go only to Queensland. So the city was segregated.
And how did that transform? What kind of businesses popped up to service?
All the local shops, went over to serving Southern Fried Chicken and, soul food, really.
There were barbers that could cut African hair, weren't there?
Presumably. Yeah. And, the Trocadero, which was the dance hall on the south side, the dance halls on the north side were Cloudland and Palm Grove. Actually, the Trocadero probably had the best music because it was the black music.
When you had family holidays in the 1940s and early 50s, where would you typically go to go to the beach?
Yeah, well, almost everybody in those days went down the bay, and that meant to Redcliffe, Scarborough, Margate, Woody Point, all of those Stillwater beachside suburbs on Moreton Bay. Good for kids, utterly safe. And there were slippery slides at either end of the beaches, and there was always a pier. The pier at Redcliffe was the really grand one, and it had all those games that you could play. It had big silver weighing machines where you got a ticket with a story on it, and lots of those machines where you could play with two sides of a football team. Wiggling the
foosballs, yes.
And the Cooper, which was the boat that went from Brisbane to Bribie Island and stopped off at Redcliffe, that was the place where it stopped on its way between the river and Bribie Island. So that was all very much like an English watering place. They were modelled on English watering places, and they had the names of English watering places. Scarborough,
yes.
Margate,
Ramsgate,
Sandgate. And even Southport, because Southport was on still water on one side of the Narang River there. And then on the other side of the river there, there were all surf beaches, but they had not yet really come into existence. They didn't really, through the 30s, they began to be built up, but they only kind of sprang into existence as an alternative place for Brisbane people to go in the very, very last year of the war, or after the war.
And then it all changed. Sometime in the early 60s or thereabouts, yes, I think. Yeah. It all changed.
Huge change.
And the culture became Californian.
It became a surf culture, a proper surf culture based on surfing shorts rather than swimming costumes, which even for men had a top, because men didn't appear in a swimming costume that didn't cover their torso as well as their rest.
All of our lifestyle became California, didn't
everything
it?
Became
we shifted
California.
Out of those old English homes into bungalows.
And that was a huge change. There were beer gardens, for example, sprang up. There were different kinds of drinks from the ones we had once had.
Cocktails, that's right, cocktails arrived.
All of those things happened.
It was such a change. And then your family shifted their circumstances too, didn't they? The old home you'd had in South Brisbane, your mum started her own business, and you were able to move to the further outlying, more prosperous suburb, if you like, of Hamilton.
Yes, where we had at last, as my father would always have wanted, a brick house.
A brick house.
Which he designed and built. One of the things that had happened was that South Brisbane had been rezoned as a factory zone, not a residential area. And the result of that is an interesting one. It meant that the government, because it was a factory area, and the government were able to acquire all of it to turn into the expo site, and then to turn actually into the South Bank. So really what we owe in the city, the South Bank and all of that great development there too, is the fact that the black Americans came and made all that side of the city undesirable.
You write quite a bit about Australia and Australian history and how we see ourselves in your essays in the first place. There's lots of really lovely and interesting ideas there. I was struck by the way you quote an idea of Bruce Chatwin's that he mentioned in his book Songlines, which was that thought that, you know, if the Russians had settled Australia, been the first Europeans to settle Australia as opposed to the British, we might have occupied much more of the interior. But because it was the British were a seagoing people.
Yeah, an island people.
An island people. We see ourselves as an island rather than a continent.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, Central Europeans, especially Poles and Russians, have a great sense of plains, huge, open expansive space, and they're comfortable with that. And they define their souls in terms of that expansive space. You know, being a seagoing people looking always to the sea is a different kind of thing. So we had come to an island, another island, but it just happened to be the biggest island in the world. And, you know, if you look at Australian history, for the first 30 years of Australian history, all our industries were sea industries, sealing and whaling. We did not think of having, for example, a pastoral industry until about 30 years into settlement, and it was only then that we thought we better look and see what's on the other side of those mountains and see if there isn't pasture land, because now we want pasture land.
One of the things I realised from reading, I was ashamed I didn't know it before, was that one of the big impetus for the British government setting up a colony at Port Jackson in Sydney wasn't so much as a penal colony, but as a kind of an outpost for the East India Company.
Yeah.
A viable port.
Yes, they actually had a contract with the East India Company, which the Prime Minister Pitt deeply was very suspicious of. So they did some kind of deal where they got some control over the board there. But the East India Company had a monopoly on all ships that came in and out of that port until 1819.
So that's it. It was just too uneconomic to have it purely as a penal colony. That's far too long a distance to send prisoners,
I think actually they were interested in the port, before they were interested in finding a solution to the penal question. And one of the reasons why that port was very important was because all the other ports were in the hands of the French or the Dutch or the Portuguese, and they couldn't trust the fact that a continental alliance between those people would not close those ports to them. But Cook had also opened up a new route, which was the route to the south of the continent.
Yes, that's right.
The Roaring Forties, which was hugely faster. So, in fact, you could get to India quicker by going that way, as long as you had a port somewhere on the east coast.
Well, to duck under Australia,
yes.
Pop up to Sydney, and then yes. go to India yes. back yes. across again.
Yes.
You said in your Boyer lectures that in Australia, we've always been forgetting that we're an experiment in this country. Tell me what you mean by that, the idea of Australia as an experiment.
Well, even that penal colony was... the British had passed a law in 1773 that... no convict, for example, in the country could be asked to work without being paid, because to be unpaid was to be a slave, and there were no slaves inside the British Empire. So when they set up the colony, it had to be built and maintained by someone. It couldn't be built and maintained by free settlers, because they wouldn't go there. They refused to have slaves, which is a huge decision and a good one in terms of our future.
You think of the lack of that burden in Australia. Yes. That, you know, there has been indentured labour here with the Canucks later, but by and large we escaped that awful business of slavery like the United States.
Yes, so it had to be convicts, but the convicts could not be simply used as slave labour. So they had to be paid, but their pay was to be their board and lodging. But if they were skilled labourers, they didn't have to do any labour at all. They could do their skilled job of being bricklayers or whatever, and they could actually employ someone to do the government work for them. And all of those people were regarded as free on the ground. That is, from the moment they arrived, they were essentially free men. This is the notion. It didn't always work out that way. And what they were sentenced to was transportation, not anything else. So when the period of their transportation was over, they were free to go back. But they didn't want them to go back. So what they did is they gave them land. The moment that they were done with their sentence, 5 or 7 years or whatever it was, each man got 50 acres of land, his wife got 30 acres of land, and each child got 30 acres of land. Now, these are people who had become criminals mostly because they had no economic power. Economic power back where they came from was land. If you owned land, you were a gentleman, you could vote, you could make the laws. So here, these people who've been criminals in one place are being made landed peasants in another.
If there was an experiment, it pretty quickly began to produce some really interesting and radical results. For example, you know, convicts sent over here. It was really widely thought at the time that the convict stain was something, criminality was inherent, and it was something you'd pass down to your genes. But convicts brought out here and set up a nation that is one of the most law-abiding societies in the world, for all our kind of images of lawless larrikins.
Yes.
You know, we obey the law in this country, don't we? Yeah.
Yes. Well, look, maybe, the vast majority of those convicts actually reformed. And their children, after all, were free. And I think that first generation, as we see in all the literature, they were very, very proud to be the first native-born settlers of the country, and regarded themselves as superior to the people who simply came in later and were not born here. So the native-born was a very, very important distinction.
It's your 80th birthday this week, as I've said several times now. recently, Martin Amis was on the program. The author Martin Amis is now in his 60s, and I talked a bit about getting older with him, and he said, once you reach the end of your 40s, you think to yourself, oh, that went a bit quick. And then he says that, and you think it's only going to get thinner and thinner. But then when you get into your early 50s, he said, there's this whole new suite of rooms in your house opens up, which is the past, because you realise you have a past. And I was just struck, you said something very similar to that early on. And he says, by the time you reach your 60s, he said, you feel that, well, that's not going to get thinner and thinner. It's going to get richer and richer because you have these more rooms that open up, which is a past to remember. What happens when you approach 80?
Well, I think there are even more. What I think of it, it's very easy. I mean, memory is an extraordinary quality in us. And it's very easy to think of memory as being leading to nostalgia. But it doesn't necessarily lead to nostalgia. It's quite possible to think of going over as something that happened to you. And, you know, writers are very good at stepping back, not just in a kind of thin memory of the thing, but into an actual entering back into the space with the real light there and the real moisture of the air there or whatever it is. And that's a bit like going back to a book that you read when you were 16 and reading it again at 60 and discovering that the book may be the same, but you have changed to the extent that the rereading means you see so much more. You see so much that you missed the first time around. And writing is a wonderful way of dealing with that, because writing is the only one of the arts where you can actually, it belongs to time, but you can stop time at any point and say, okay, something is happening here that requires me to look at this thing which happened only in 2 seconds over five pages, because I can stop here and stop the camera and examine every little detail that I couldn't have seen the first time around, because life goes so quickly, real life. So that going back in memory may be a more intense examination of what happened than anything you could have felt at the moment.
It's the perfect segue into one of your poems. Now, there is a poem in your new volume of poetry, Earth Hour, and it's called Retrospect, I think. It seems to me, anyway, to be about how people from the distant past can pop up in one's own dreams, I suppose, as you get older. I'd love you to read it. Would you please read it?
I'll read it. It's actually a little event that happens in Jono. You know, when with a friend, I went for a walk right across Paris to Sèvres. Retrospect. A day at the end of winter. Two young men, hooded against the silvery, thin rain that lights the forest boughs, are making towards a town that at this distance never gets closer. One of them, not me, as he turns, impatient for the other to catch up, wears, even now, when I meet his face in dreams, the look of one already gone too far into the forest. As when last night, in sleep, I looked behind me out of the queue for an old movie, and you were there, hood thrown back, your stack of dirty blonde hair misted with skyrack. And when my heart leapt to greet you, know your glance, in the old conspiratorial way insisted, don't speak, don't recognize me. So I did not turn again, but followed down the track to where, all those years back, you turned and waited, and we went on together at the bare end of winter, breath from our mouths still clouding the damp air, our footsteps loud on the rain-lit cobbled street down into Sèvres.
Thank you so much, David Malouf. How lovely to speak with you, and happy birthday to you once again.
Thank you, Richard.
David Malouf's collection of essays is called A First Place, and his book of poems is called Earth Hour.
That conversation with David Malouf, who passed away last week, aged 92, was recorded by Richard in 2014. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.